Hey friends, it's Elena.
And it's Candace.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. Today, hope y'all are doing good. How are you, Candace?
I wonder if there's people like in their car going, "I'm good."
I'm good. How are you?
Work space, whatever. I'm good. Thank you for asking. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm excited to tell this story today.
Ooh, I'm excited.
Today we're talking about Cheryl Hauser. So, Cheryl Ann Fair was born on May 9th, 1961. She loved to help. She loved to nurse animals, to tame animals, and have all kinds of pet animals when she was young. She grew up and became a neonatal nurse.
Aww.
Renee Fair, Cheryl's sister, says that she was an angel on earth. Cheryl met her husband, Greg Hauser, in high school, and the two married in 1983. She ended up going to nursing school, and together they had three kids. They lived in Mansfield, Illinois, and Cheryl worked at Carl Foundation Hospital. Cheryl was a member of Our Lady of the Lake Catholic Church. Greg was a mechanic and a volunteer firefighter. And by 1990, the marriage became very troubled.
I was wondering when you were going to get to this part.
Yeah, that's the seven-year itch, I think.
Yeah,
that's what they say.
Seven-year itch. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yep. So Greg filed for divorce, and Cheryl made the counterclaim. However, even though Greg filed for divorce first, he didn't make it easy for her. He would get jealous, and he would get mad about her seeing other men, or he would accuse her of seeing other men.
Okay.
So she ended up filing charges once, saying that he held her down.
Whoa.
And she had bruises on her arms. So he was arrested for battery, and things just got worse.
This escalated prickly. You're rubbing up on me. This escalated pretty quickly.
Yes. I try to tell more about their previous time, mm-hmm. but there was not a whole lot to tell. So it just all the reports I saw just got right down to business.
Yeah. So you're just getting right down to business.
So here I am. I tried, okay. So she ended up filing for a restraining order, and the restraining order said not to intimidate Cheryl or her family.
Okay.
So I think that's a very broad.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So even after all of this, Greg and Cheryl was given joint custody and had to share time in the house. So to my understanding, Cheryl would stay at the family home for 3.5 days with the kids, and then they'd switch off. Greg would come and stay there the other 3.5 days so that
wow.
the kids didn't have to be uprooted.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
This is a new strategy.
Well, yeah, I've heard of people doing that. It's good for the kids, but I feel like it would be very overwhelming for the parents.
I mean, I know, like, Jennifer Garner and Ben Affleck, he lived out, like, in the pool house or something for a while.
Oh.
You know, they were not together, but he lived, like, in the backyard and
okay.
kind of so he could be a part of the family, but they weren't together.
Well, and I bet that pool house was the size of a regular house, too.
I know. He probably wasn't hurting.
Right. Greg and his friends would hide in a cornfield and watch Cheryl at the house when it was her 3.5 days.
What?
Yeah.
That's creepy.
So
that's scary.
Well, and to be a friend and agree to just go sit in a cornfield across the street. That was so weird.
And three of them. You get three of your friends to agree to that.
Greg called Cheryl over to the house one day when he was at the house and begged her back. And when she refused, he attacked her and sexually abused her.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So the court records that I read say that on September 20th, 1990, Cheryl received a phone call from Greg asking her to come to the family home because of a sick child. After checking on the children, Cheryl had a conversation with Greg where he asked her to come back to him. When she refused and began to leave, Greg grabbed her, dragged her into the bedroom, pushed her onto a bed, restrained her with a nylon rope that he used for hunting, and gagged her.
Jeez.
Yes. Greg restrained Cheryl with the rope by wrapping it around her wrists, her neck, and face. He put his hand in Cheryl's vagina and his penis in her face, ordering her to perform oral sex or else she would be in real trouble.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, very, very aggressive. Greg eventually let Cheryl up and ordered her to write on a piece of paper that she had consented to have sex with him. Cheryl attempted to escape, and Greg grabbed her again, pulled her back into the house, bent her over the couch, and attempted to get her to sign a blank piece of paper. Cheryl was able to free herself and ran to the neighbor's house.
My gosh. I bet she thought she was dead right then.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. Like, I mean,
oh my God.
Fighting for her life. The neighbors allowed Cheryl inside their home and noticed abrasions and swelling to her lips, scratches and swelling to her eyes, marks on her neck, and bruises on her wrists and legs. Cheryl stated to the neighbors that Greg had tried to rape and strangle her. Police were called, and Cheryl was upset and crying, making it difficult for her to speak to the police officers. The officers observed Cheryl's injuries, which they believed were consistent with Cheryl's story. The neighbors went to the house and spoke with Greg. Of course, he denied that it happened. The officers took a look around and saw blood and a pearl earring on the master bed. The officers noted that Cheryl was wearing the matching earring in one of her ears. So Greg was arrested and charged with aggravated criminal sexual assault and unlawful restraint.
Good.
Based on this, Cheryl was awarded temporary full custody of the kids, and Greg was granted 3 hours of visitation. So fast forward a couple weeks to October. Cheryl was trying to move on. She was dating another man. And like I said, just over 2 weeks on October 5th, 1990, Cheryl's coworker would call 911, telling them that Cheryl did not show up for work, and asked them to go check on her at her house. You see, before she called 911, she called Cheryl's house phone, and the six-year-old answered.
Oh, no.
The coworker asked the child where his mommy was, and he said that mommy was sleeping in the garage with a rope around her neck and won't wake up.
Oh, God. Oh, bless it.
I know.
Oh,
heart-wrenching. A volunteer firefighter and neighbor went to the house and found Cheryl hanging from a nylon rope, partially laying on the ground. She was 29 at the time of her death. The kids, the three kids who were 6, 3, and 18 months were in the home unsupervised.
Oh my God.
Greg, being a volunteer firefighter, showed up at the house asking what was wrong with Cheryl, and the other people there did not let him in. So upon investigation, they can see that the rope had been tied 3 times around her neck and knotted behind her head. Her clothing tag was caught up in the rope, and a piece of latex glove was stuck in the rope. There was no sign of forced entry. And of course, the scene was photographed. And one of the photos showed Cheryl in her nightgown with a blood stain and saliva on her shoulder. She had bruises and dirt on her feet and dirt on her nightgown. A used condom was on the floor in her bedroom.
What?
Semen was not found in Cheryl's body. Lab techs did test the latex glove piece and did not find any DNA on it. But there wasn't any latex gloves around the crime scene.
Right. Mm-hmm. So she obviously did not put gloves on and then tie rope around her neck.
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, she was not wearing latex gloves. Yeah. So Greg was interviewed. He said he stayed at his grandparents' house that night and stayed up with them until 10:30 p.m. He was supposed to be living with his parents after the separation and order of protection, so this was not a normal thing for him to be staying at his grandparents'. One of the reports that I read said that it had been years since he stayed at his grandparents' house, so why he stayed at his grandparents' house that night?
Were they home?
Yes, they were home. He said he stayed up with them until 10:30, so when they went to bed at 10:30, he said he went to bed.
Okay.
He said that he had not seen Cheryl since September 24th, and he said that they hadn't even had sex since August, and he accused Cheryl of sleeping with other men. He accused her of doing drugs and said that she had depression. Which were not true.
Well, even if they were.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like.
Well, he said, I'm sure he said depression just because they made it look like that she killed herself. Mm-hmm. So, the family was questioned and said that none of that was true. So, upon speaking to friends and family, investigators learned that the day before, on October 4th, Cheryl went to her parents' farm with the children. Later that evening, Cheryl returned home with the children, and Cheryl's neighbor saw her getting the children out of the vehicle that evening. That same day, Greg attended a going-away party for a friend, and Greg's friend, who was moving away, testified in a prior deposition that Greg was the first one to leave the going away party.
Is this one of the field friends?
I'm assuming, I don't know. No names were ever given that I saw.
Because I can't see this guy having more than 3 friends.
Well, he was a volunteer firefighter, and usually that's a brotherhood.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I don't know. The individual hosting the going away party recalled that Greg was not at the party at the end of the night.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that was October 4th. Mm-hmm. He said he was staying the night at his grandparents, but yet friends say he was at this party.
And what time was that?
Yeah, there was no timeline.
He says, oh.
Well, there's no time given about when he showed up to the party or when he left the party. They just said he was the first to leave, and he wasn't there at the end of the night. So, I don't know. Did he go to the party, then go to his grandparents and stay up with them till 10:30?
Interesting.
I don't know. So into the wee hours of the morning of October 5th, a patrol officer was watching the streets around the area. He noticed at 1:40 a.m., a suspicious car that was driving around the streets very slowly. The officer ran the license plates of the vehicle and discovered that the car belonged to one of the men that would help Greg spy on Cheryl in the cornfield. The officer observed another man in the passenger seat of the vehicle, but could not identify him. The officer thought it was suspicious enough to take note, but he did not investigate any further. Dang. So the manner of death was undetermined.
Oh,
so
my.
Did she do this to herself, or did someone murder her? After all, she did love her babies, and she would never leave them alone. She was a caretaker, and caretakers usually think of others before self.
Right.
Especially your little babies. You're not going to leave them alone.
Right, exactly.
So, in the following May, after Cheryl's death in October, Greg, he went to trial for the sexual assault charges from September.
Oh, wow.
He had a friend testify. Yeah, so that was still ongoing. He had a friend testify that he was there the night in question and did not hear or see any assault when Cheryl was at the house.
Please. How do you not hear that violent encounter?
Because he wasn't there. He's just saying he was to help a friend out.
That's stupid.
The defense filed...
Just sit in the cornfield, you know what I mean?
Yeah. The defense filed a motion that made it so that the jury couldn't be told why Cheryl did not show up to court.
What?
Yeah, they couldn't be told that she was...
Excuse me?
Yeah.
They couldn't say, oh, she's not here because she was murdered.
No. They were not allowed to bring that up to the jury. So, ultimately... Greg was acquitted on the charges of sexual assault.
That is infuriating.
Yes, ma'am.
Like, oh, she didn't show up, so...
Guess she doesn't care.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Wow.
Cheryl's murder case went cold, of course. Years later, investigators re-examined the evidence from the scene. The used condom showed that Cheryl and Greg may have both been contributors. DNA from the scene shows two male profiles that did not match Greg.
Hmm.
So did he have a friend help?
Yeah, interesting.
Her injuries looked fresh and new. Abrasions were consistent with a sexual assault. The marks around her neck were not the markings of someone that would have hung themselves.
Right.
The rope was so tight that she would have passed out before she even was able to hang herself.
Yeah.
The rope was tied in a way that someone had tied the rope around her neck. They determined that she was likely strangled.
Mm-hmm.
A crime scene reconstructionist came in to take a look, and he felt that her body had been laid flat and then raised up by the rope. The lividity and blanching markings on her body were consistent with being moved after death.
Mm-hmm.
So if you didn't know, blanching happens when changing the position of a body, causing the blood to resettle and discolor.
Oh, okay.
So the dirt on her feet and nightgown was consistent with being dragged. Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
At this point, it's 26 years after the murder, and with all the expert opinions, the coroner held a second jury inquest to present all of the evidence as it supports homicide. The jury agreed that it had been, or that it had to be homicide, and so 2 months later, Greg was arrested and pled not guilty.
It took that long?
26
years. For them to change? Oh, Lord.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane.
Frustrating. The case went to trial, and he was denied bond, so he couldn't live freely anymore.
Go out and murder anyone else? Okay.
So, in June of 2017, the trial began. Cheryl's sister testified and gave a character witness on Cheryl's behalf. she said Cheryl was making plans for the upcoming Halloween festivities, like making their costume, the kids' costumes. She was making financial decisions, and things like this shows that she was planning for the future.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
The prosecution was also, they were allowed to bring up the previous sexual assault charges in the murder trial. The pathologist, Good. Yes. The pathologist that reviewed the case in 2011 testified that Cheryl had been strangled by hand and that the rope was placed around her neck. And another investigator testified that the used condom found on the floor had both Greg and Cheryl's DNA. The oldest child, and I think at the time of the trial, he would have been around 33, if I did my math right, he testified
Girl,
as well.
Girl, that's on you.
I know.
I can't help you.
Math is hard, okay? So her boys told the courtroom that their dad had taken them hunting one time and showed them how to dress a deer by hanging it in the exact same way that their mother had been hung in the garage.
Oh my gosh.
There was some complications with evidence in the case. Apparently there was a blood stain on Cheryl's nightgown that was not shown in the crime scene photos. The DNA from that stain did not belong to Cheryl or Greg, so they thought it may have been a transfer stain from medical personnel.
Oh, gosh.
The defense tried to claim that the stain belonged to the true, real killer, and since the DNA was not that of Greg, Greg couldn't have been the one to kill Cheryl.
Okay, what about his cornfield friends? Did they get tested?
None of that was reported.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it took 26 years.
I know. It's not like they're on the ball.
If they interviewed and, yeah. So, however, the prosecution was able to definitively show that the blood stain was a transfer stain, probably from another body at the morgue.
Oh, my.
I know. Oh, it probably happens all the time.
Yeah.
It probably happens a lot.
Wow. I have a question. So, where did they find this stain? Like, at what point did they discover the stain was there?
I'm assuming, I think in 2011, when they re-examined the case and got all the evidence out, maybe
it was
on there. So, it
wasn't
an
initial thing that they... I'm just wondering... Yeah, because that would have shown that it was after the crime.
Yeah, because it wasn't. It was not in the crime photos.
Crime scene photos, yeah.
Crime scene photos, yeah.
Yikes.
Yes. So the prosecution tried to bring in a psychiatrist to the trial. However, the defense won a motion to have the psychiatrist blocked from testifying. This certain psychiatrist had performed a psychological autopsy and determined that this was very interesting to me too.
Okay, go on.
So it was a psychological autopsy and determined that Cheryl had not been suicidal. Apparently, it's not a physical autopsy of your brain. It's interviews with close friends and family. It's reviewing diaries and emails, and like these days it would be text messages. It's
okay.
I don't know why they
I mean, call it something else, because psychological autopsy is a very strange,
it's very misleading
to yeah, exactly. I thought you were gonna tell me that he cut open her brain and he could tell by, like, certain lobes or certain areas of the brain that she wasn't suicidal because it was this big or that big.
That's exactly what I thought when I saw that. I was like, wait, what?
Oh, my gosh.
Like, the wrinkles in your brain can tell you that?
Yeah.
No. Okay. So, yeah, it was interviews with family, friends. It was, I don't know if she had a diary, but it's reviewing all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So they determined she was not suicidal. A year before Cheryl was murdered, another woman was attacked in the same area. Something like around 2 miles away from her home. This woman had been jogging, and the man approached her and started a conversation and started to attack her. He knocked her out, sexually assaulted her, and left the scene.
Oh.
So the defense claimed that the attacker had to be the same person in Cheryl's murder.
Sure. That totally adds up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A year ago.
It's the same.
Yeah. It's not like it was a month ago.
Right.
One of Cheryl's best friends testified that she begged Cheryl to move away from the home that she shared with Greg and feared for her safety. Mm. The defense called Walter Rohr to testify. He testified that he and Cheryl were friends and she would confide in him about her troubles with Greg. Walter had been to Cheryl's home, he said, about 4 times. And sometime in July or August of 1990, Walter and Cheryl spent the day together. They ended up having sex. And he said Cheryl laid on his chest after they had sex, and she stated, "If Greg knew about this, he would kill me." So he told Cheryl, "We made a mistake, and this can't happen again," and she agreed.
So that was the defense? The defense called this guy?
They called him because they were trying to say he had sex with her, that condom belonged to him, and he didn't tell investigators at the beginning that he had a sexual relationship with her, so he was lying. Okay. It had to have been him.
So but it backfired.
I think it backfired on them. Yes. Ultimately, after a 2-week trial, the jury found Greg guilty of raping and murdering Cheryl.
Good.
I just wanted to act like you.
I love it.
The defense asked for a retrial, stating that the claims of past sexual assault should not have been admitted since Greg was found not guilty at the time of the charges. At Greg's sentencing, he was 57 at this time. His ex-girlfriends and ex-wife, he remarried in 1997, I think I saw.
Okay.
And she came and gave they all gave character statements that Greg was violent. Mm-hmm. And he ended up being sentenced to 55 years in prison. Of course, the defense team filed for a more lenient sentence, stating that
I'll get a life.
This is basically a life sentence.
Yeah. That's because what happens when you take a life.
Yeah. And, of course, the judge pointed out that Greg got 27 years of freedom after murdering his ex-wife,
mm-hmm.
and so he stuck with the original sentence.
Good.
Yeah. In 2020, Greg was still making appeals, of course. Cheryl's sister, Renee Fair, started an organization called Fair Advocacy and Consultation to help those in domestic violence. She talks to others about her sister's story and her experience, and she does consultations to determine how to help and navigate and understand the process for those that are going through something like that. She also wrote a book called The Wheels of Justice. It's the story of her 27-year fight to get her sister's killer convicted. So she constantly worked for her sister.
That's amazing.
In the report with WCIA News, Renee says, "I have to tell you that I think I shed more tears writing the book than I did through the events as they unfolded. She said, even though her sister is physically gone, writing the book made her feel closer to her. She added, going through her files, her records, and her notes, at times I almost felt her presence in the room with me. I think Cheryl is proud of me, and I know she lived to help people, so for me to continue that in her name and her honor, I'm sure she's proud of that. And she just wants people to know that they're not alone in their fight.
That's amazing.
Yes.
I'm so glad she was able to, like, do something productive with her grief.
Yes.
And she probably found it so healing. Like she said, feeling her presence when she's writing this book. And whoever has the opportunity to go through someone's notes and journals and while they're alive.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I wouldn't just go into my sister's room and start reading all and rooting around in her stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I bet she felt closer to her than, like, that she knew her better than she ever had.
Yeah, and she's able to write everything down, process everything, and...
Yeah.
So, yeah, and that's what grief is. It's a process.
Mm-hmm.
So I just also want to add that if you or anyone that you know is a victim of domestic violence, a few tips and things to do is just know that it's not your fault. Tell someone. Get an order of protection. Document the abuse. And just leave. I know this is very difficult. It's easier said than done.
Yeah.
It's difficult for some to do, but please know that you are strong and there's help out there for you.
Yeah.
Have a safety plan put in place, and call 911. Just call someone for help. You can reach out to the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233. That's 800-799-SAFE. There's also a website called womenslaw.org. It provides legal information and resources for each state, as well as helping you find shelter and counseling. If you want more information or would like to reach out to FAIR Advocacy and Consultation, the website is www.reneefair.com. That's reneefair.com.
Thank you for saying all that, because I know there are people that hear these crime stories and they're like, they totally identify with the fear and the feeling entrapped. And one of the hardest things that I've heard from, like, a firsthand friend was the financial abuse, like being a prisoner to someone else's pocketbook, I guess you could say. Not having anything, like not having a job if you're a single mom and you, or not single mom, if you're a stay-at-home mom and you look after your children and you don't have a job, you don't contribute financially to your family, and you know, I can't just leave.
Yeah.
I mean,
where am I going to do
that? We have no money. Yeah, exactly. Where am I going to go? How am I going to feed my kids? And I will say something I thought about when you were giving all those resources is you can always reach out to us.
Yes.
If you want, you could just send us an email, tell us specific instructions, like how we can help you, how we can get in contact with you, and we won't respond to your email. You can just delete it out of your sent messages, and it's like it never happened. 'Cause I know that... a friend of mine was in a really bad relationship, and she said, he checks, like, who I call, who I email, and so just find a way to reach out to anybody.
That's a good point, because on some of these websites that I was going to, it pops up with a thing saying, this is the phone number to call. If you go any further, you may not be able to cancel this history, basically. It's not those words, but like they know that there's people that's going to check your computer history. And So, that's a good point. But yes, definitely send us a message if you need help. We are here. I mean, if you just need someone to talk to, a friend or... we will do what we can to help you.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're not alone. You are strong. And we love you.
Yeah.
So that's it for my episode today, y'all.
Thanks for that. That was, it's tough because I know as a friend who, I know you mentioned her friend, like said, she encouraged her to get out and stuff. It's so hard for friends to intervene, even if you know your friend is in danger, because you feel like you're overstepping some kind of boundary or, you know, oh, I shouldn't root around in other people's relationships, even if you really feel like they're in danger. Yeah. Like, I need to say something. Yeah. I've experienced that myself. Like, what do you say? What do you not say? How much do you hound this friend to leave? And she ended up leaving, which is great. But I toiled with that. Like, I really struggled with how far do I go with this? Do I give her resources to help get her out? Do I make a plan with her? Like, how far do I go? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, do I wait for her to reach out?
Yeah, and
help?
That's all you can do. Sometimes that's all you can do is just give the information. Here, this is what I've researched, and just be there for them. There's been situations where I've tried and tried, and the friend just didn't want to hear it. They wanted to stay in that situation, and I had to back off. And
Oh, that's a tough one. It's tough. What a piece of crap. What a piece of garbage. I mean, he's obviously was a violent person, but I just can't understand how you could assault someone who you loved and you were married to and had children with, and you know what I mean? Like, I just, you take it to that level.
Yeah.
Ugh. That's a tough one.
Right. One, he's the one that filed for divorce first, but yet he's going to make her life miserable.
And,
like, he was going to get what he wanted.
Yeah, and he's, like, bringing up that she's already sleeping with other men. So what? You filed for divorce. She can do what she likes.
Right.
I hate the character assassination bit that they always do, you know? Oh, she was doing drugs.
Yeah,
she was seeing other guys. Well, even if any of that was true, it's not relevant. She didn't deserve to die.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, well, thanks for that, Lena. Feel good, happy ending. I mean, it is a happy ending. Like,
that was not one. Yes.
He's gone. He's in prison, hopefully. For the rest of his life. Was he eligible for parole? I couldn't remember if he said that.
I did not have any of that information. So it just says that he was sentenced to 55 years.
55 years.
Which he's 57, so he'll be 100 and... Like I said, I can't do math, so...
He'll be dead.
Well, and hopefully none of these appeals that his... I mean, and his lawyers still... is like an innocent man went to prison.
Get real.
You know, he's still advocating for him.
What?
I don't know.
Come on.
I don't know.
At some point you have to just wash your hands of the situation.
Well, yeah.
Come on.
I don't know.
Is this Jose Baez, his attorney? Ay, ay, ay. Well, good job for painting a visual picture of that story. I felt like I was there.
Well, thank you.
Rest in peace.
Yes, rest in peace, Cheryl. All right. We'll let y'all go. Hope y'all have a good one.
Enjoy the rest of your day, night, morning. See ya. Wouldn't want to be ya.
Bye, y'all.
Bye now.